Welcome. This is Kat Steele from the Urban Permaculture Guild, and I'm glad to see everyone here tonight for our seventh event in the Solutionaries Spring Series. And tonight I'm really pleased to have with us Aaron Lamer from the Bay Area Relocalization Network. And he's going to talk to us about the various projects that are happening right here in terms of what we can all do as community members to face the coming oil crisis. So thank you for being with us.
Thank you. My name is Aaron Lamer. I'm the project coordinator for a new multi-county initiative based here in the East Bay, but it's actually covering the nine-county Bay Area, and it's called Bay Area Relocalize. We've been going for about 5 or 6 months now, and since an initial strategy meeting in December where 40 community leaders came together to look at how we can bring the production of food and energy and essential services closer to home, we've developed a really solid team and are moving forward on this idea and developing partnerships. And I'm going to speak to that tonight, describing it in the context of peak oil. How many of you in this group are familiar with the concept? Okay, and I'm not going to have to do too much convincing, but there is a nice snippet based on a movie called End of Suburbia, and it kind of outlays the situation in which we find ourselves, I think, really succinctly and pretty powerfully as well. So if you'll bear with me, I'm going to play that for you, and then we're going to get into a discussion about peak oil and the response of relocalization as one of the solutions that we as communities here in the Bay Area can embark upon. Let's look at a snippet from End of Suburbia.
The whole suburban project, I think, can be summarized pretty succinctly as the greatest misallocation of resources in the history of the world. America took all of its post-war wealth and invested it in a living arrangement that has no future.
The basic cause of it all is the end of cheap and abundant energy.
Cheap oil is the party that we've been enjoying for the past 150 years. And that party is coming to an end. Within our lifetimes, we're going to see the end of the age of oil. And the result of that will be the end of the American way of life.
Will you stop honking back? We ain't going nowhere.
You think you got it made? Good job, carnally paid for. So you get a little home in the suburbs. Away from the city smoke, out from the shadows of the factory. Raise a few kids, some flowers and vegetables. The big dream coming true.
The suburbs wouldn't exist if it weren't for cheap oil. The U.S. is a car culture. The automobile industry started in the U.S. And really, the automobile industry got its start here because we were looking for ways to use that cheap oil. The U.S. was awash in oil in the early 20th century. In the 1930s, they were discovering the stuff so fast that oil in Texas was cheaper than drinking water by the carload. The car companies quickly became the engine driving U.S. industry and economic growth. The result of this is that we have created this new system of habitation where people live miles and miles from where they work and from where they get their food and all of their other necessities based on the idea that they can and they must hop in their car at any moment and travel miles and miles. And the only way that works is on the basis of cheap energy.
Now we're stuck up a cul-de-sac in a cement SUV with an empty gas tank.
Most people, when they think about oil, think of when we're going to run out. And really, that's the wrong question to ask, because oil in the earth is not like oil gasoline in the gas tank of your car. When your car runs out of gas, then you know there's a problem. But it doesn't run out until you get to the last drops. But with oil in the earth, it's a very different situation. We can't just pump oil out of the earth at any arbitrary rate.
So what you get is this curve. It starts, pulls up quite quickly, get more and more and more out, then you reach this peak or plateau.
When you get to about the halfway point, the rate of that you can extract the resource peaks. And after that point, no matter how much effort you put into it, you can't continue extracting the resource at the same rate. The rate of extraction peaks and begins to fall.
We're sort of in the middle right now. We're right at the peak. We're at the point where the world is producing the most oil it will ever produce. And we are going to enter the arc of decline very shortly, if not already. It's a little bit unclear whether or not we've actually already entered it.
Great crises, by definition, are problems that got ignored until they were enormous problems. And I think we have a great crisis coming in energy. What I'm most worried about is how long we've left even addressing the issue. And the longer we ignore the issue, the more painful the problem will become. If you start appreciating how finite and fragile the use of energy is, you know, there's small things that can be done. Can any individual solve the problem? No. It takes a massive collective wake up.
The crux of the issue, I think, for most ordinary people is we're going to have to live more locally. And we're going to have to at least prepare mentally to do that.
Two or three centuries from now, people will be looking back and formulating myths about the way people lived back then in that. Whether they'll look at it as a lost golden age or an age of horrors and insanity, I'm not sure. I think it may be the latter. They'll look back on us and they'll say, my God, who were those people? How could they be so stupid?
Irony was the ethos of the late 20th century. But as we move into the 21st century, we're going to discover that irony is a luxury we can't afford anymore. This stuff isn't just funny. Our lives are going to depend on whether we have an environment that's worth living in and that can actually support the project of civilization. You know, we're not just going to be able to sit back and make fun of it anymore and enjoy it ironically. That part of our history is over. It's time to get serious.
But right now, you can ride along with the Happy Go Spending, Buy It Now, Young Adults of Today.
So, I want to speak to a number of issues today, since you're all very familiar with peak oil. But what I would encourage you to do is to think about, as I go over some of these points about what the situation is that we find ourselves in, think about how these can resonate with other people. Think about how some of these points may or may not lend credence in your own lives and how it might actually help in persuading others to understand the situation that we're in. Our project, Bay Area Relocalize, is of course inspired in some part by the situation of peak oil, but there are many other rationales for choosing to relocalize, which we're going to get into in some detail in a little bit. But I want to revisit the case for peak oil for those who haven't thought about it for a while. Of course, we all know that oil is a finite, non-renewable resource. Unfortunately, believe it or not, there are a number of individuals out there who are putting forth a theory that it's actually something that's part of a creamy center of the earth that is in infinite supply. It's called the abiotic oil theory, and this is being touted by some who do not wish to really come face to face with the implications of peak oil. Needless to say, it is a minority in the thinking body of opinion out there, but it is something that we have to contend with from time to time. Also, M. King Hubbard, who I'm going to turn to right now, he's known as the grandfather of the peak oil movement. This year actually marks the 50th anniversary when Dr. Hubbard made his forecast for peak oil in the United States. At the time, it was crazy to think that oil was going to be running out. As you saw some of the commentators speak to in the film, there was this notion that it was going to last forever. There would be no possible way that there could be any decline in the availability of this abundant resource. So he thought, okay, looking at the data, seeing where discoveries were being found and projecting into the future that it was going to be maybe somewhere around 1970, you know, give or take a few years. And this was in 1956 that he made this prediction. It was very poorly received, shall we say, at the time. In hindsight, he turned out to be exactly right. In 1970, the U.S. did peak in the lower 48 states and has been in constant decline, has never produced as much since. Also, I should take note that a tribute website has been set up, so if you're interested in learning more about M. King Hubbert and his contributions to this whole thinking around peak oil and the implications beyond just the resource use, but about what the implications are for us as a society and how we're going to need to transform the way we live in order to adapt. A third major aspect of the case for peak oil is the understanding that really discoveries that have taken place in the past, major oil discoveries, really peaked in the 1960s. Looking at this graph here, you can see that there was a major increase in discoveries leading up into the mid-1960s, and that major discoveries since then have been in progressive decline. Now, M. King Hubbert also was noting that you're going to have a period, a delay of several decades, you know, after which the infrastructure is developed and the ability to access the oil is improved upon and built up over time, and that consumption of the resource is going to mirror the discovery over time. So you can see that several decades later, we're entering into that mirror effect of that curve, mirroring the discovery period that was peaking in the 60s. Now, it's not often discussed in the popular energy literature, but 54 of the 65 largest oil-producing nations are now in decline and have already peaked. Some energy companies are finally starting to admit to the problem. There's a website out there some of you may have heard of. Chevron has started a new website called Will You Join Us? And this is a public acknowledgement that the end of cheap oil is over. The era is over, and that they've set up this forum for discussing, okay, what are your thoughts about this? How can we find new resources and adapt for the future? So other companies have also joined the bandwagon in acknowledging it, although there's different levels of acknowledgement, obviously, due to investor jitteriness and other concerns. But it is starting to be acknowledged within the energy sector. Perhaps one of the most compelling things to have come out recently to lend credence to this idea of peak oil is what's called the Hirsch Report. And that was actually commissioned recently and released last year. It was commissioned by the Department of Energy. And it was actually really specifically looking at what would be the impacts on our society if we did not prepare. What would happen if we did face a huge energy supply disruption in the United States at all levels of society? And what Hirsch and some of his colleagues who wrote the report discovered was that unless we prepare at least 10, but preferably 20 years in advance with some kind of major crash program that would involve restructuring our economy, it would involve really finding alternative uses of coal technology, for example, turning it into liquids, etc., all of these ways of ramping up alternatives to oil, that we would be facing economic upheaval, essentially. And it actually called for a project that would be on the order of a Manhattan-style, you know, effort that would involve major infrastructural changes and huge amounts of trillions of dollars in investment. So if a 20-year time frame wasn't available, there would be serious dire consequences, and there would be extreme consequences at the 10-year frame. We're looking at now, according to the Association for the Study of Peak Oil, with a possible production peak in global oil in the year 2010. So needless to say, that doesn't give us the window of opportunity that would be preferred by Hirsch and his associates, but there's still incredible opportunity that this challenge presents for us, and I'm going to outline that in the coming portion of my presentation. Here's where we are right now. This graph demonstrates that in the year 2006, we're probably just a few years off from seeing the maximum amount of oil that will ever be extracted from the ground. And you can see that we have the majority of regular oil indicated in the orange zone, and that other zones, especially the one that you see that's directly above it, are starting to take off in the downward trend after the peak. And those are the heavy oils that are now starting to become more economical. They're harder to reach, harder to refine, but they are starting to become economical because now that we're in the $69, inching up toward the $70 per barrel range, these harder-to-get-at oils are now becoming much more economical. So much so that I think Hugo Chavez was able to state recently that Venezuela now has more available oil than Saudi Arabia. Questionable, debatable, but you can see where the price point factors into this whole question. This is essentially a slide that is outlining how dependent we really are on oil. Some people think, okay, well, oil, yes, we know it's important, but really how fundamental is it to our daily lives? I consider it to be the lifeblood of modern industrial civilization. And that's indicated just by the sheer levels at which we're using it, which is now 84 million barrels per day. It's also 43% of world energy fuel consumption and constitutes 95% of total transportation energy. I think what's particularly alarming to me, I'm somebody who grew up in Iowa with all these fields of corn surrounding me, and I thought, wow, how is all of this being produced, right? Well, it turns out that 10 calories of fossil fuel energy are being applied toward the growing and the harvesting and the production and processing, etc., for every calorie, single calorie of food that comes to our dinner table. That's an extreme vulnerability within our system, I would hasten to say. And when you think of the dizzying array of products that really we depend on, that are based on oil, on the order of 500,000, it really starts to boggle the mind in terms of our dependency. Plastics, clothing, medicines, lubricants, asphalt, etc., all sectors of modern society would be dramatically impacted as oil starts to enter into decline. And I should say that, just briefly, that predictions around what the other side of the peak oil curve would look like varies considerably. There are some who have a petro-collapse notion of what that would look like, meaning that just looking down on the other side of that curve would create so much panic that could lead to a dramatic contraction in the economy on the order of, you know, beyond the Great Depression. Others feel that there could be a steady decline, if managed properly, of 3% per year, such that we could adapt and plan for those changes over time. So there's quite a spectrum of opinion on what that can look like, but in the end, it's up to us what that's going to look like. So I'd like to also point out that just the density and the flexibility of oil is really unparalleled, and the amount of work that you get out of one barrel, for example, amounts to 138 weeks of human-powered labor. That's like 23,000 work hours or something like that. So when you think about how much energy is being used for everything that we do and how much that would represent in terms of human labor, it's dramatic. So this naturally brings up the question, well, what are the alternatives? Can't we just plug and play and put in some alternative suite of energy sources that will keep industrial civilization humming at the same degree that it has been for the last 100, 150 years? I was one of those very positive thinking, I still am a positive thinking environmentalist. Okay, I'm not going to give up that badge. But I was one of those people who was very confident in the ability of renewable energy, for example, to, in combination, allow us to seamlessly move out of the fossil fuel era. I think that what this is showing here is that we have a very low amount of potential combined energy that we can expect to gain from the various renewables combined. This graph is showing what the current amount of energy is from these various sources, but they don't indicate what the potential is. And that is one of the things that we're going to be trying to find out through the Bay Area Relocalized Project, especially on a ground scale level in neighborhoods. I'll just say a few things briefly about some of the non-renewables up there. In the case of nuclear, that's often touted as the solution to our problems. I think it's not only worth noting about the sheer radioactivity that nuclear represents and the challenges around storage, but I think it's something on the order of $1 billion per reactor that is required, and that I don't think there's any nuclear reactor that's operating in the world without extensive government subsidies. So we're dealing with an extreme public outlay requirement for nuclear and extraordinary political challenges, to say the least. But of course, nuclear will be appealed to as energy becomes less and less available. And so I think the question for us is, what are we going to actually do as citizens to ensure that the alternatives are approached with safety in mind and with a sense of realism about what it is that we can expect to consume? Natural gas, it's also expected within the next couple of decades to peak, and that essentially it is now supplying 21% of world energy, but the discoveries of the new gas fields are dwindling. In the late 1970s through the late 1980s, there was something on the order of 9,000 new fields discovered. The subsequent decade only saw about 2,500 fields discovered. So we're seeing the same situation with natural gas, although it's in a delayed fashion. And expectations are that we can just harvest the natural gas from other parts of the world and that will solve our problems. Well, unfortunately, that means liquefying it, making it so that it can be transported across the sea, which poses security dangers, and you also lose a lot of energy in the process of doing that. And it's a rife target for terrorism. So there's real questions about the feasibility, and there's all sorts of terminals that need to be built, and et cetera. And I think there's even a federal law that has been enacted to prevent communities from opposing the siting of liquid natural gas facilities. It's really atrocious what's been going on around this whole question, but needless to say, natural gas isn't going to be our solution either. Of course, in areas of positive things that we can be doing, conservation in terms of curtailment of our use and in terms of efficiency can go a long way, but they're not going to get us all the way. But, of course, turning off lights, appliances, other electrical devices when not needed, that could have a dramatic improvement. Insulation in homes and businesses, taking fewer trips would yield enormous benefits. And then in terms of efficiency, we have extensive potential there as well. If we replaced one half of the old electricity generating plants in the United States with new ones, we could increase electric energy efficiency in the United States by 25%. And increasing U.S. average fuel economy standards to 47 miles per gallon, I know it's crazy politically, but if we were to do that, it would result in a 43% cut in fuel consumption per mile. So there are definite opportunities here, but it's not going to take us all the way. We have to do something deeper. Just want to briefly go through some of the impacts of peak oil. Clearly, there's going to be, as costs of transportation rise, a progressive decline in global trade and imports. We're also going to see the likely relocalization of agriculture. People are going to become farmers. I know that sounds kind of crazy for us urbanites, but there's going to be a lot more hired hands that are going to be needed, and we'll create our own opportunities around that. Energy, manufacturing, and culture will also become more centrally local. We'll also see a shift from auto-centered transportation toward greater transit, rail, bicycles, and walking. And of course, industry is going to have to transition away from petrochemical-based ingredients to create its products and other derivatives. And as we know, as oil becomes more scarce, we're going to see increasing excuses from governments to invade other countries to access their resources. A lot of people wonder, well, was oil a factor in Iraq? I would say that having a nation that was basically sitting on an island of untapped energy in the form of fossil fuels, if it was growing artichokes as its major export, I question whether or not Iraq would have been invaded. Needless to say, international tensions, as oil becomes more scarce, will increase. China is definitely eyeing what it can get through the Middle East. India is intending on enhancing its automobile culture. So we're going to be facing more and more competition from other societies as they seek to industrialize and create an auto-centered culture based on the United States. Clearly, that's not going to happen over the long term. So what are some responses that we can undertake in our own communities in the face of this? Of course, we can reduce consumption, increase efficiency, enact conservation measures at the personal to the local level, maybe even at the national level, who knows? And we can boost the local and regional production of energy and food and other vital goods and services. Of course, we're not going to be able to produce everything in our own communities. That's a little bit pie in the sky, but we can enhance and strengthen regional trade networks in ways that make the shipping of goods and services much less at a distance. And probably one of the hardest things that we're going to need to do is to reconfigure our cities. Right now, as you know, it's very enraging to be in traffic constantly to get from your home to your workplace. There's so much unnecessary fuel use based in the way that our cities are currently configured and so much energy wastage. We could totally reconfigure our cities in ways that would dramatically reduce the requirements of energy use for transportation, for manufacturing, for everything that we do. And it would make living in urban centers much more appealing as well. So what are these benefits of relocalization? It can strengthen local economies. I think that is something that, of course, municipal leaders are going to be excited to hear about. There's been a study that has been done recently to assess, well, what do you actually do for your local economy if you start to patronize and strengthen your local manufacturing, your local retail base? And they found that for every dollar that you spend locally, for example, that recycles in a multiplier effect 3 to 4 times in your community. And so that ends up going and supporting and enhancing this network of existing businesses within the community, as opposed to leaking it by patronizing major transnational corporations or centralized bureaucracies that will take all those dollars and centralize them somewhere else. So there's a real solid way of strengthening our economy through relocalization and create job opportunities. Relocalization also has environmental benefits. By reducing the transportation needs, you're going to be able to reduce the global warming greenhouse gas emissions. I think scientists now are saying something that on the order of 60 to 80% would be required to reduce our footprint enough in terms of greenhouse gas emissions to stabilize the planet's atmosphere. And in order to stabilize the climate, relocalization is going to help with that immensely. And of course, there'll be less pollution too, as there's so much particulate matter from automobiles. For those of you who may be familiar with the economists' doctrines of the day, there's this notion of externalities, which is basically that through globalization, we've been able to push off the social, the environmental, the labor costs that companies don't want to bear internally by shoving them off to other countries. And through the global agreement on tariffs and trade and other kinds of agreements, we've basically given the right of major corporations to determine what the local laws are, which is basically allowing us to absolve ourselves of responsibility for responsible production of what we use and consume every day. Through relocalization, that's going to bring all of these externalities, that's going to internalize a lot of them. It's going to be in their back doorstep. It's going to be in their region. It's going to be very visible and visceral in their daily lives about how we're producing things, and that's going to create a more accountable structure for cleaner production. And then there's this whole idea of community and space. I've been a mobile person. I've been moved around probably about 20 times in my life. I'm getting kind of tired of it, to be honest. It'd be nice to plant some roots and feel like there's a place I can call home. And I think that relocalization in some ways is really going to ground people in their community, and we're going to get to know each other a lot better than we have in the past. We're going to not spend so much time encased in our automobile boxes and confidently cruising down pathways without ever engaging anyone. So relocalization is going to have, I think, some strong spiritual benefits for us all as well, and it will boost our sense of community. And this kind of goes along with the idea of accountability that I was talking about earlier. By having those businesses, those entities that are producing what we need and use every day closer to home, that's going to enhance our ability to regulate. It's going to enhance our ability to govern ourselves and really to make decisions that aren't being made in far-flung places anymore. And of course, it reduces our dependence on oil from far-flung places, and hopefully will allow us to retrench from a lot of the imperial scheming that we've become kind of so unfortunately dependent upon to maintain our way of life. And also, it's really critical from a preparedness standpoint to think about how relocalization is really creating a more robust, vibrant economy for us locally, such that we could withstand major supply disruptions or price spikes in energy that we become so dependent upon. Relocalization will create a much more vibrant economy that can weather the storms that are likely to come. Now, our project Bay Area Relocalize, we have to give credit where credit is due, was very much inspired by a pioneering group of people that came together in the small community of Willits. Now, of course, they are not the Bay Area, they're not a major urban center, but we think that there are some lessons still to be learned from their experience. A gentleman by the name of Jason Bradford became a citizen of Willits and asked the question, are we vulnerable to this idea? What if energy shortages are real? What if our community is not going to be able to truck everything up from major ports and supply centers? I mean, what are we going to be doing in the face of that? And so he actually did an end of suburbia screening in the community. And amazingly, the scores of people started showing up at regular meetings and trying to figure out how they can bring energy and food production closer to their community so they can be much more self-reliant. And they engaged with a bio-intensive agriculture project, a renewable energy organization, and started to really do a serious assessment of what they could produce locally in their communities. And they've gone way far and beyond what many other communities have done, and people have been looking to them for inspiration across the country, across the world, really, for examples of what they can do locally. And we're definitely going to take some of the lessons that they've been learning through their experience and apply it in our work. So this Bay Area Relocalized project, what's it all about? Well, we're going to assess what the current resource use is in the Bay Area. What's the consumption that this nine-county area is currently at in the areas of energy and food and other vital materials that we're using on a day-to-day basis? And then we're going to make some determinations about how our communities can seriously reduce the consumption of imported resources. We're also going to reveal through on-the-ground assessments the extent to which we can produce food, energy, and other vital resources to replace those imports. And in the process, we're going to be building community, business, and municipal support for a relocalization agenda. Now here's what we call a self-reliance map. You can see that at the very top there, kind of visualize a cup, if you will, and think of it as in terms of all the resources and what we're all consuming. At the very top line, of course, we have the 100% line. This is all of what we're consuming at a given point for any resource. Now, conservation measures, efficiency measures, those can have a real effect in reducing what would be required ultimately for us in terms of consumption. And that really helps us to identify what our real need is. And then also that determines what the wastage is in our current economy. Next, we want to assess what the local production really is at this point in time. Now, that line looks probably around 5% or so. It's probably much closer to like 1%, maybe even a little bit lower than that, actually, especially for food. But what we want to do is we want to see, well, given the available land area, given the configuration of our current living spaces, what is the potential local production that we could generate here in our communities, first and foremost, and then bioregionally? And that gives us a sense of what the potential local production would be and what our vulnerability would be to, like we were talking about earlier, with those spikes in energy and possible disruptions in what's coming to us. So let's apply this to food. You can see that at the very top, there's a lot of things that we could be doing in the area of conservation. We could be reducing all sorts of restaurant waste, home food waste. And there's this radical concept of actually consuming less. And that boosting the local production, when you're looking down toward the bottom line and moving up toward what we could potentially produce, we could implement a lot of community gardens. We could do backyard and rooftop gardens. We could find unused and reclaimed land and create urban farming spaces and create food and composting cooperatives. All sorts of new arrangements are possible when you think about it. But beyond that, when you look at that middle zone of where it's going to be required for us to do some trading, there's obviously not going to be the potential for us to do everything in our communities. But as close to our communities as possible, we can strengthen our regional trading relationships. Already, there's just an amazing burgeoning of community-supported agriculture, farmers' markets that are spreading like wildfire across the country. These things deserve greater support, and they can be through policy measures that would allow for cheaper access to food for communities. We could implement these things and help regionalize our trading of food and essential services. Similar things could be done for energy. All sorts of potential, and if we're going to be having competition for this space as people start to identify rooftops for gardens or energy, and so our project is having people within these different committees, which I'm going to talk about soon, meet together so we can discuss what those potential trade-offs might be. So this project is going to be carried out in three phases. In our first phase, we're trying to develop a methodology that really could be applied by different communities. We want it to be flexible, extensible, something that people can learn from and adapt, and you know they're going to run with it and make it much better over time. We know that this is going to be an evolving project. So we don't want to reinvent the wheel, though. We know that there's a lot of existing studies, similar efforts that have been done, not necessarily in the context of relocalization, but with the idea of seeing how much we could produce locally in food, in energy, in other key sectors. So we want to gather those together. We've done that to some extent already, but we want to make sure that we're, like I said, not reinventing the wheel and doing studies that we don't need to do, but synthesize that information and find out where the gaps are so that we can then apply it and develop a methodology for looking very specifically at key areas. And once we have that methodology developed, we're selecting two Bay Area communities. We've already developed some relationships with some organizations in Oakland and several in San Francisco, but we haven't selected them yet. We want them to be contrasting, definitely one that has a little bit more of a gentrified community. They're facing serious economic hardship, what the potential is for that in terms of relocalization for that community, and then by contrast, a more affluent community that has resources to bear, and see what the different options are going to be in each of those. So obviously, this is quite a tall order for the Bay Area proper, but those groups that I was noting earlier are also all in communication, and we're keeping other folks updated about what we're up to. So these two key neighborhoods, we're going to be doing this on-the-ground assessment, will really help develop that model, which I was saying earlier, that other groups can then apply, and then we're going to have that be shared within this network so that people can learn from each other and then develop a more overarching sense about what's possible in the Bay Area. As we identify what the potential is, every step of the way, we're going to be looking for economic opportunities. What kind of green building business opportunities are there? What kind of energy revitalization opportunities could there be? Obviously, farming is going to take a little time for people to get used to the idea, but that's going to be a key area of development as well over time. And reconfiguring our cities will involve extensive reconstruction, retrofitting, etc. So there's going to be many opportunities, and we're going to be identifying those every step of the way. Once we have a solid sense of what the potential is, we're going to arm ourselves with that information and make sure that it's made part of the municipal policy agenda. A really important recent development that happened in San Francisco through the work of one of those organizations, SF Oil Awareness, has been meeting with supervisors one-on-one to talk about peak oil and how the city of San Francisco can prepare. And they unanimously, this past week, passed a resolution stating that the city of San Francisco is on record as a city that's going to conduct a study about the vulnerabilities that they face in regard to peak oil. It's going to give a charge to agencies to look at what San Francisco can do to prepare and even commit to some funds. We're not sure what that's going to be yet, but this could actually help channel some support from the municipal level toward relocalization. Once we have this study, I think we're going to be in a much better position to say, hey, look at what this gap is. Let's look at this vulnerability that we're facing. And with this set of opportunities alongside it, we think that we're going to be able to build a strong constituency of support for this relocalization agenda. Now, the project is actually organized in committees, people who have expertise in areas of food, energy, water and sanitation, housing, built infrastructure, and arts and culture and education. People are stepping up. We already have three of these committees that have started meeting and started assessing what the existing studies are around these issues. And they're composed of people who are interested in the research, who are interested in the issues, people in community organizations. And once the neighborhoods have been identified, we're going to make sure that leaders from those neighborhoods are empowered to really do this on-the-ground assessment. We certainly don't want this to be a top-down process. We want this to be a collaborative, evolving approach where we're learning from each other and that can have some concrete benefits for the communities. There's the steering committee, which is composed of some of the people from the relocalization committees so that we can be talking together and making sure that we're not working at cross purposes, and an advisory panel of people with particular expertise in these areas so that we're keeping ourselves in check about some of our assumptions and being sure that we're crossing our T's and dotting our I's. We also have some threaded committees. These are people who form a committee as a whole, but are also embedded as individuals throughout the other relocalization committees. This is to help identify, as I was speaking to earlier, this whole notion of what the economic opportunities are, and those are the commerce and work folks. We also have a municipal threaded committee that's looking at how we can establish greater relationships with municipal leaders toward this agenda. Social equity committee, so that it's being done in an equitable fashion. We're not leaving people behind in this idea. And land use, so that people who have different ideas about how we can use those backyards and those rooftops and et cetera are talking to each other and figuring it out in a way that makes sense. And of course, people working on fundraising and media and outreach and how we can make sure that we're communicating these ideas in ways that resonate with people and that speak to their experience. So to date, I'm happy to say that we have developed a core team of 10 people who have been meeting regularly for months now. We've held three community events, one at the Ecology Center, one at Laney College, and we had a day-long relocalization workshop that sold out with 45 participants looking at how they can engage their communities that was held at the Humanist Hall. And we've attracted dozens of volunteers. Now we have a local network of about 400 on our listserv, And we've entered recently into strategic partnership with the folks at Redefining Progress, the International Forum on Globalization, and the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies, and Post Carbon Institute, which incubated this project. So we're looking at how we can combine our efforts and really make this a strong relocalization effort. And we've got some support from various community organizations. Probably amongst these, as far as food and energy are concerned, are People's Grocery, City Slicker Farms. We have the support of the Urban Permaculture Guild, and the folks at the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights, I think, is also worth noting, because they've been doing some amazing work with the program called Reclaim the Future to look at formerly incarcerated folks and low-income communities of color especially, and how these opportunities can factor into a green collar agenda. So this is definitely, you know, some exciting possibilities for synergy here. So what are we going to deliver? We're going to create a flexible localization assessment model that different locales can adapt in their own areas. We're going to make sure that we're providing a summary of those resources as we capture the data so that people can more readily identify where the available information is, like for their local municipal energy agency or their permitting agency to find out how many solar panels have been installed in their community. So this information can be more readily identified. And we're going to give them step-by-step instructions for applying the model. And of course, they're going to come back to us and say that didn't work at all. But that's okay. We're going to be open to that, and we're going to learn some lessons along the way. So again, it's going to be applied in two key locales in the Bay Area, and we're going to make sure that the leaders from those communities are given every opportunity to modify and make it particularly relevant to their neighborhoods. And we're going to do some media outreach every step of the way to make sure that we're, I guess you could say, fertilizing the soil and the media landscape to some extent, because this whole concept hasn't quite, I don't think, permeated, especially the idea of relocalizing. It's going to take some convincing. And then every step we're going to be looking at how are we successful in mobilizing the community around this agenda and providing tools and lessons learned to those who are applying it in their own locales. So with that, I'm going to open it up, and I'm going to also just briefly introduce a couple of my fellow project team members here. Christopher Pease has been doing some tireless work on behalf of the project to get the word out, has been reaching out to the media, writing some press releases, and we're fertilizing that soil, shall we say. We've gotten so far a cover story in salon.com. We had a stealth reporter come in and look at this whole concept, so that was a major coup. And David Room, who initiated the project, now a consultant with his own firm, Energy Preparedness. So thank you so much, everybody, for coming here tonight. But I'd like to turn this into more of a discussion, and please let me know if you have any questions about the film, about energy, and this whole idea of relocalization. So thank you.
This was produced by the LA Sound Posse and may be freely copied and distributed. You can visit us on the web at lasoundposse.org.